Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to kick things off by telling you what the Texans moves and the Jets moves of the last month tell us about the NFL. Then as always, we hit all the news of the week with Jenny and Connor and wrap things up with a six pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome back in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. There's a few days left, two, 3 days left in the offseason calendar. Then the NFL breaks for a month. And that has not stopped the news over the last couple of weeks. In fact, Friday afternoon was a really, really strange one by offseason standards. We had the Texans firing their general manager. We had the Jets just an hour or two after that announcing their new general manager after having fired their GM just a few weeks ago. And I want to start here by just explaining what I think this means, explaining what I think the hire of Joe Douglas with the Jets means, explaining what I think the firing of Brian Gain in Houston means, and we'll get into each of those moves with Jenny and Connor in a minute. But to me, what all of this is, the NFL is, has been, will be going forward a coaches' league, maybe even more so than it's a quarterback's league, much more so than it's a players' league, and certainly more than it's a scouts' league. It is a coaches' league, and when I look at this, I look at what's happened in Houston over the last couple of months, the addition of Jack Easterby, who's from New England, which is also where Bill O'Brien came from, the empowerment of Jack Easterby as an executive vice president there, outbidding for Jack Easterby, beating out the Panthers and Dolphins to go and get him, all the things that have happened over the last few months and leading into the firing of Brian Gain. I actually don't think that this was about Brian Gain as much as it was the owner, and this is a new owner because his father passed away recently, and Cal McNair, listening to his head coach and believing the best thing to do is to listen to his head coach. And again, we're going to get into the particulars on this one, but I just think that this is really about what most owners believe, what most people in the league believe, which is if you feel like you've got a good head coach, you get behind him, you do what he says. And I think that that happened in New York with Adam Gase. I think that's happening now with Bill O'Brien. And to be honest, I look at this and I don't know that you can really argue with the logic that much. If you look at where the NFL has been over the years, look at the four teams that were left at the end. Andy Reid leads the Kansas City Chiefs. Sean McVay, clearly the face of the Los Angeles Rams. Sean Payton, he's been the New Orleans Saints, who the New Orleans Saints have been over the last 13 years, and then Bill Belichick, of course, maybe the greatest coach of all time in New England. Those are the four teams that were left at the end. All four of those coaches, McVay, Reed, Payton, and Belichick, all carry a big stick in their organizations that does not end with what goes on the field. They have their hands in the medical part of it. They have their hands in the contract part of it. They have their hands in the player acquisition part of it. And so successful franchises, for better or worse, a lot of them over the years, the sustained winners, have been driven by strong head coaches. And this goes back through history, too. If you want to look at some of the dynasties, some of the teams that won for a lot of years, you know, you look at, obviously, the Patriots of the last two decades behind Bill Belichick. Before that, you want to look, Denver won a couple Super Bowls. Mike Shanahan had more power than anyone in the league. Jimmy Johnson wins three Super Bowls in 4 years in Dallas. Why do you wind up leaving there? Well, because the owner wanted to curtail his power. Bill Walsh, very powerful, very involved in player acquisition in San Francisco. Same with Chuck Knoll going back to the 70s in Pittsburgh. And then if you want to look at the ultimate one, that's Vince Lombardi in Green Bay, who used to actually tell his players, if you have a problem with it, you can go see the general manager. I'll be in my office in a half hour. And so, you know, I just think, and I'll bring in Jenny and Connor now, I don't think it's necessarily right what happened to Brian Gain. I don't think he deserved to be fired. But at the same time, I think what we're seeing is what we've seen in the NFL over the years, which is that the NFL is a coaches league and owners empower their coaches if they believe they've got good head coaches, you know. And in this case, if you're Cal McNair and you really believe in Bill O'Brien, or you're Chris Johnson and he's new too, and you really believe in Adam Gase, this is just sort of what you do. And I don't know if that's right or wrong, but history tells us that the teams that win biggest are the ones that have the strongest head coaches, or at least that's the most common result.
I feel like the Jot situation is different from the Texans, though, because Adam Gase is hired and sort of is entered into this arranged marriage with McCagnan, whereas you know, O'Brien is now going into his third general manager, and just, you know, a little over 1 year ago had a role in a hand in picking Brian Gain, right? So how do you go to the owner and say, yeah, you know, this decision that I played a role in a year ago, I'm going to reverse course on and try to bring in someone new, when a year is really not any length of period of time to evaluate a general manager on performance. You have no idea what this year's draft picks would look like. Obviously didn't have a chance really in last year's draft because of how much they had given up previously to get Watson. So that's an interesting conversation, right? I mean, what do they say when O'Brien says, I want to get a new guy, this guy that I helped pick a year ago. I don't think I made a good decision there.
Yeah, I'm gonna disagree with the premise of the being a coach's league just a little bit, and make like kind of two points here. The first is that I don't think it's a coach's league as much as it's an owner's league, and then whoever has the power is the person who convinces the owner that they're the most indispensable person. In a lot of cases, that is a coach, because they're trained to kind of have that bravado and that, you know, leadership, that salesman experience. But in some other organizations, it's certainly, you know, and maybe not good organizations, but, you know, there are definitely other people that have had, you know, a stranglehold on the power because they're the ones that have the owner's ear, and maybe that shifts and that moves and changes and stuff like that. But to Jenny's point, yeah, I mean, I think this entire thing with Houston is ridiculous. Not only because, you know, Bill O'Brien not only had a hand in picking Brian Gain, but you go back to the videos that they posted of the Texans war room, how excited they were about you know, their first round draft pick. Everybody was nodding, everybody was high fiving, everybody was all in on this together. And then 2 weeks later, you're deemed that he's not good enough, perhaps by this Patriots character coach. I mean, the whole thing just seems insane to me. And now your strategy is to just get more Patriots people in Houston. Like, show me any other organization in the NFL where that has worked, because I think a bunch of other teams have tried that and none of them have won a Super Bowl.
Okay, so we'll just jump right into the news topics of the week then. As always, I try not to read what Connor writes because I want to react to it naturally. And this dovetails right into news item number one, which is the Texans became the second team in a few weeks to fire their general manager post-draft, deep-sixing Brian Gain because an internal investigation found he just wasn't good enough. Houston is now doing the same thing that many successful organizations do, plucking more members of the Patriots organization in the belief that they can replicate their winning ways. Connor, I know what you're getting to here, and I agree with that. I think it's impossible to replicate what Bill Belichick's built in New England, because Belichick is an outlier. And people I know that have worked there and people who have seen the way that place operates from the inside, what so many of them tell you is it's almost like Bill, it's almost like there's like four or five of him. It's hard for other people in the organization to comprehend how he gets everything done so efficiently, but they turn around and everything is done. And so I think because of that, there is alternately, you know, on one end, it's hard to replicate that because Bill is such an outlier and he is so different. On the other end, you know, you have coaches who come out of that place and believe that that's the right way to do things because their experience was that that worked. And because they saw, okay, like we're acquiring players to fit what the head coach wants because the head coach is bringing the players in and the buck stops with him. I think trying to replicate what the Patriots have is a fool's errand. And I think if that's what the Texans are doing here, that's the wrong approach, because I think it's just impossible to replicate what they've got in Foxborough. If this is about getting Nick Caserio, it makes it a little more understandable. And I think that that's what this is about. So if this is about getting Nick Caserio out of Foxborough, if this is about Jack Easterby knowing that he's going to be able to pry Nick Caserio out of there, well, then it makes a little bit more sense. If this is about replicating the Patriot model, Connor, I'm with you, then that doesn't make as much sense.
Well, and, you know, you sort of alluded to this on Monday, I think, Albert, when you said, you know, is there some kind of agreement already in place, right? Do you make this move with Brian Gain? Do you have to know that you can get somebody that you really covet? And I think that's going to be interesting. Obviously, we're recording this on Tuesday, and who knows what happens over the next 24 hours before the podcast posts. But I think that's going to be the interesting wild card here, is like how much of this was set up before they made that move.
I don't know. I mean, is Caserio a home run hire or what? I mean, do we consider this, you know, a slam dunk? Because I don't know. I mean, if you talk to scouts that work from other teams or scouts that know Patriot scouts, I mean, this isn't exactly like, you know, a team that people are dying to go scout for. It's not exactly, you know, it's not like,
well,
the Seahawks.
So like we all know, like, the coaching, taking from the coaching side hasn't really worked out, right? Like, you know, if you're poaching coaches, like, that's been kind of treacherous for other teams to go into New England and take coaches out of there. The going and getting GM candidates out of there actually hasn't been so bad. Scott Pioli won a division title in his second year. Obviously, it went the wrong way. That was largely related or connected to the quarterback decision they made in bringing in Matt Cassel and obviously his relationship with Todd Haley. But, you know, like, there were some good players in the roster when he was there, and he was able to kind of set the table for Andy Reid. Thomas Dimitroff in Atlanta, he's been to a Super Bowl. John Robinson seems to be doing a decent job in Tennessee. And so, I understand where it's kind of scary for another team to go in and poach a coach out of New England. I don't know. Do you guys think it's maybe a little different on the personnel side? Because maybe there's less of a tendency to just emulate whatever Bill did.
But I think the challenge, right, is that you're charged with building a team in Belichick's image, how he wants it to be built in New England, right? And he lays out specifically, we want players in this role, and this is where the game is going, and these are the kinds of things that we need. And so I think trying to replicate that somewhere else is difficult, because what is O'Brien's vision for the team and how it's built? And you can't match Belichick's knowledge and understanding of how to put pieces together on the field, right? So without that sort of guiding force, would you be as effective? And maybe you would be. Listen, I'm not saying you wouldn't. I just think that is still, it's still a big leap.
Yeah, I don't know. So, I'm not sold on this. I think this is just, you know, this is crazy. And this is not just unique to the Texans, but it seems like any of these power plays that have happened recently are people just hiring people who they're friendly with or who they have a previous working relationship with, which, like, how many good ideas in football back when, you know, all this stuff was coming out and everybody was coming up? I mean, look at the documentary on that they did on the Browns coaching staff when they had, like, Jim Schwartz and Nick Saban and all those guys. I mean, they all hated each other and they didn't agree with each other. And Bill Belichick hated Bill Parcells. And, like, you know, you put all these people in a room together and you let them fight it out because that's what it takes. And that's where good ideas come from. But, you know, if you're just hiring a guy that you know is going to get you the players that you want in the draft, I mean, you know, what in Bill O'Brien's track record has shown that this has worked throughout the first five general managers that he's had in Houston?
I'm going to be really interested because he's now run off two general managers in 18 months. Right. And that is crazy. Like, that is just that is, and the maybe the craziest part about it is, like, you're hearing the same stuff now that we were all saying when Gain was hired, which is, this is about fit and alignment, right? Like, so you're hearing the exact same stuff to explain Gain's firing that you were hearing to explain his hiring and Rick Smith's firing. And so, you know, I think clearly this puts a target on his back. And if this is about what I'm really interested to hear, to see here, because my understanding of how this all went down, and you guys can, everybody out there can read it in the column on Monday, was Jack Easterby sort of led an assessment of the football operation. That led to some tension. People knew what his job was in New England, to sort of grade the coaches, grade the scouts. And so, you know, like, there was some tension in the building because of that. And Jack Easterby's very close with Nick Caserio. Bill O'Brien's very close with Nick Caserio. And so what I'm interested to see is, when Cal McNair signed off on this, was it Cal McNair betting on and pushing his chips to the middle of the table on Bill O'Brien? Or was it him betting on and pushing his chips to the middle of the table on Nick Caserio? Because I think we'll find that out. Like, I think if Caserio is the hire and it happens fairly quickly, then I think it was a bet on what Bill O'Brien told him about Nick Caserio, that this is a difference maker, right? And rather than it being about Brian Gain being out of there, it was more about, okay, well, we think this guy's an upgrade. if it's not Nick Caserio, if this winds up being someone else, well, you know, then it's a bet on Bill O'Brien. And that's even more interesting because then, you know, the model becomes more about him. Maybe he has more control. Maybe it's harder to find somebody who's willing to go there. I think it's going to be fascinating to see how all of that plays out. And I think O'Brien's done a pretty good job the last 5 years. He's put a lot of pressure on himself, and to win two power struggles this way, to be able to have things set up the way that he wants them, now it truly is all on him, whether or not this is a Cal McNair bet on him or a Cal McNair bet on Nick Caserio.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it sets a bad tempo for the organization. I think it just floods the place with bad juju. That's what I'm saying.
It'll be interesting to see what
they full of bad juju. You just need a juju fumigator in there.
Yeah.
Juju Smith Schuster might object.
That's true. He's good. He's a good juju.
Good juju. Okay.
All right. Well, we're going to change the juju in the room right here with topic number two. Who wants to take this one?
I got it. Carson Wentz and the Eagles both take a leap of faith, inking a contract before Wentz's fifth-year option season and before the quarterback market eclipses the $40 million per year mark. Is this a good idea, a bad one, or will it not make a difference in your life at all? Wow. Deep thoughts by Connor Orr.
The existential questions here from Connor Orr.
That's right. I mean, smart by the Eagles, I think, to do this now.
I agree. I think, like, if we look at where the quarterback's market's gone, it's crazy to think. And what was Kirk Cousins' deal? It's 15 months ago now, right? The quarterback market has gone from $28 million per to $35 million per in 13 months, right? So that's, I'm not great at math, but I think that's a 25% hike, right? So
that's pretty good math on the spot there, Albert. We're impressed.
Well, I can divide by seven, so I got that for me. If Dak's deal gets done, if Goff's deal gets done, I think the big one, of course, is Mahomes, right? Like, if you get this, like, if you're able to get a discount now, you feel comfortable with his knee, you feel comfortable with his back, you feel comfortable with the spring that he's had. I mean, what are they going to do in the next 2 years? Are they going to suddenly pull the plug on Carson Wentz after they just let Nick Foles go? No. They know he's going to be on the team. They know, they feel pretty good about where he is physically. There haven't been any hiccups in the spring. And so, like, to me, like, this is, it's a bet, but I don't even feel like it's a huge bet. Like, I feel like it's, you already have, you know, a couple of months of evidence of him being in the building and working, you know, after, you know, post injury. In a weird way, you're sort of able to take advantage of this injury situation because I'm sure he feels a little vulnerable, right? Like, you would too if you had a back injury and you had a knee injury and three of your last 4 years playing football were seriously affected by injuries. I think they were able to sort of take advantage of that too. And like, knowing that he's a little vulnerable and saying, like, you know, do you want some financial security now? Like, we won't pay you at the top of the market. We won't move the needle all that much, but we're willing to give you something in that ballpark. And $32 million. I mean, after a time when we saw, what was it? I think it went Derek Carr to Andrew Luck, then to Matt Stafford, then to Jimmy Garoppolo, then to Kirk Cousins, then to Matt Ryan, then to Aaron Rodgers, then to Russell Wilson. We saw one after the other. Everybody was topping everybody else. Like, the fact that the Eagles avoided doing that, and now this deal may look really, really good in a year or two after Patrick Mahomes gets his deal. I mean, for that small risk that Carson Wentz maybe doesn't become who they think he's going to become, I think it's absolutely worth it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. The fact that he has had some of the health issues allowed them to get it done now and reduce some of that leverage that he said, you know what, maybe I should wait, right? I think it made them both eager to get a deal done on the same timetable. I think it will be interesting moving forward. Like, at what juncture in time does Mahomes think it's worth it to do a deal, right? Like, the longer you wait, the numbers go up. So obviously the Chiefs would want to get that done as soon as they're able to, but Mahomes would perhaps be less inclined to do that right away and might want to drag out the process a little bit more.
Am I the only one that thinks that Eagles fans should be like a little bit more nervous about this? I mean, Wentz is a system quarterback who a lot of this is based on his mobility and has had ACL and back injuries in the last 2 years. Like, I do think that there's definitely a little bit more of an element of risk than we're talking about. I mean, it's, I think it's a smart time to hedge if you're Howie Roseman and put your money on it, because if Wentz gets hurt again anyway, you know, it's going to take you a while to find another franchise quarterback that's comparable of him at the top end of his skill set. But at the same time, I mean, you know, those are two fairly significant issues, right? And while a few months of clean health is good, we've seen quarterbacks that have had a few months of clean health before, you know, falling into, you know, or reverting to something that stokes one of these old injuries again.
Here's the way I look at it, though, Connor. Like, and you're right. Like, I think, like, the back is I'd actually be a little more worried about the back than I would the knee, because I think ACL injuries happen. It feels like half the quarterbacks in the league have had one. Like, a big man with a back problem, like, that does concern me a little bit. The way I look at this is, like, what is this, like realistically, what would be the soonest that they would pull the plug on Carson Wentz? Like, 2 years from now? 3 years from now? Right? Like, realistically, if we're looking at this and, like, his history, and you take everything into account over the last 3 years, what do you think? Like, let's say this goes the wrong way. What would the soonest be that they would, like, legitimately say, okay, we're ready to pull the plug on Carson Wentz and go draft another one? Probably 2 years from now, right?
I agree with 2 years. Yeah.
Okay, so I look at the guarantees in this deal, and I haven't seen the whole deal yet, but $66 million fully guaranteed, right? That tells me that this is really probably just a 2-year deal with team options after that. And so, you know, I think you make your player, you make your quarterback, like, you give him a nice little bump there. It's way more than he'd otherwise be making the next 2 years. If it works out, the benefit for the 4 years after that is enormous for the team, right? Like, now all of a sudden, they've probably got salary cap numbers like 25, 26, 27 million in those last 4 years, when the quarterback market could be just astronomical. And so the way I look at it is, the soonest that you would be pulling the plug is 2 years from now anyway. And so you're giving yourself, I think, this 2-year window where you've got to pay more, and that's the risk. And after those 2 years, you either go one way, which is, you go forward with him because you believe in him, and now you got a great deal, or it didn't work out and you're out of the guarantees, and yeah, you paid more over the 2 years, but now you can actually, you know, you'd actually have the flexibility at that point to move on. So it just doesn't feel like that big a risk to me the way that they did it.
I think Joe Banner had a really good breakdown of the contract on the Rich Eisen show, and he basically boiled it down to saying that they locked up Wentz for 4 more years for just $35 million in guaranteed money. Mm-hmm. And I do not know the exact nitty gritty well enough, but that seemed like if you look at it in those terms, that does make sense, right? I mean, the Eagles are taking a little bit of a gamble, but it has a very huge upside. And that doesn't even seem like that terrible of a gamble to take.
Do you guys think it affects Dak Prescott or Jared Goff at all?
Well, the Goff situation is interesting to me. Like, are they even 100% committed to extending him?
Mm-hmm.
I think the Rams are so interesting because of the effect that McVay had on Goff and how aggressive they've been in using that. I think they're going to commit long term to Goff. But if you're them, I mean, are you at least, like, even thinking about, like, well, how much of this has been McVay the last 2 years? And they've been so aggressive about taking advantage of having the rookie quarterback deal. Like, you wonder, and they're generally kind of like an outside the box thinking organization anyway. You wonder if with them they think, well, Sean could probably do this with another quarterback. Maybe could do this with another quarterback. So do we, like, if you're the Rams, do you have to think about that too?
I think it's a fair consideration. I mean, again, then you have to start over and, you know, you think, okay, well, we got to this point with him and maybe they're not willing to do that. But if in their internal evaluation, they think that a lot of it has been McVay. I mean, I think the likeliest scenario is they do re-sign Goff, right? But there is a different way of thinking in which they could just say, you know what, like, we do like how we've built our roster. It got us to the Super Bowl. We trust that McVay can do this with another quarterback that we don't have to shell out this huge contract for.
I'm all in on that. Just get weird. You know what I mean? Like, why, you know, just do it.
How about this? Get weird with Blake Bortles.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's sitting there, right? I guess there's your option. What about Connor Orr? Could you slot in?
Do you honestly think, like, if Sean McVay had like 4 years with me behind the scenes,
could you complete one pass in an NFL
game? One pass in an NFL game.
That would be a great experiment.
So it's 4 years.
Paper Lion part two.
I'm working out with Tom House for four years, and then every day I go home, and then Sean McVay is at my house, and he's like, "All right, Connor, you know, here's what we're gonna do with all this, the plays and stuff," and then we go through all that.
That's not a bad McVay.
That was really good.
I know.
That was really good.
I was sitting on that one.
Was it you that were recently telling me that people who do imitations are smarter?
No, that they just have thinner inner ear cartilage.
Oh, damn. Okay, sorry. Really misrepresented that factoid. But you have very thin inner ear cartilage, evidently.
I may have thin. But so I go home every day, and he's there, and he's running me through everything. And then, you know, I have some live drills and everything like that. Week one, after the 4 years are up, so I'll be 35. So that's kind of an issue in itself. But 5'8". You know, so I'm not, you know, I'm a little shorter than Kyler. Do I complete one pass in an NFL game, like downfield?
I was going to talk about one of those touch passes for you.
like a slip screen.
No, just like the ones where, you know, they just release on the guy in the sweet motion, right?
Yes.
You just pop it forward. like a glorified handoff.
Connor flips the jet sweep to Robert Woods and gets the hell out of there.
One pass of 5 air yards or more.
No. Sorry.
Well, you would be at your fighting weight too, I would think, because you'd be so focused on getting it right that, you know. So
I would have to, for once in my life, take nutrition and health seriously. Yeah, I would have to. No more McDonald's, Wendy's. Yeah,
sports
I would have to
science.
Really, yeah, I would have to
science.
Really get
no
into
super
sport.
Bar. Well,
so you didn't answer, right? Yes or no?
I think you could, yeah.
Oh.
Because I have faith in McVay to scheme that up for you.
You don't have faith in Connor. Well, I mean, I said no, so I have no faith in Connor. So I have no room to talk.
If I completed one pass, I'd ask for a contract extension.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
There is no easy way to transition to topic number three here. Connor, you take that one.
All right. Well, investigators have determined that the broken arm suffered by Chiefs receiver Tyreek Hill's son was accidental. There still seems to be a prevailing feeling among investigators that a crime of some kind has been committed. Until the fallout from this entire situation is clear, the burden now seems to fall on NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell to determine whether any punishment, if at all, is warranted.
And, like, I just... Well, let's start here. I really feel like the Chiefs, like, it just feels like they're hoping this is going to go away. That's the way that I see it. And, you know, it's like, oh, well, we're deferring to the NFL. That's what the guidelines say we should do. We should defer to the NFL's investigation. The NFL is deferring to Child Services. And, you know, I can't help but think, guys, like, what if this wasn't Tyreek Hill? What if this was some average player? If this was some average player, like, the guy would have been cut almost immediately and would be gone right now. And we probably wouldn't be talking about him. The NFL might not even be investigating him because it wouldn't be their problem anymore. And so it feels to me like every piece of this is an effort to get him back on the field that has nothing to do with what happened with his fiance, that had nothing to do with anything that happened with his son. It's about the fact that he is maybe the fastest player in the league and an impact guy and all that different stuff. And I think that's too bad, you know, because this just, again, like, we saw how the Chiefs reacted to the Kareem Hunt situation in November and December. And, like, they were more than happy to take all the praise that was coming their way for that. Like, they acted swiftly and decisively. And I think this is just another example, you know, like we saw in 2014, where I still believe the reason Ray Rice wound up out of the league. I mean, obviously part of it was the video, but I think a huge part of it was that he wasn't the same player anymore. And so a bunch of teams decided he wasn't worth the trouble anymore. And I think that's why Adrian Peterson got a second chance. And I think that's why Greg Hardy got a second chance. And in this case, I think that's what this is again. It's a player's ability to perform on the field is affording him all sorts of leeway in a just absolutely heinous situation.
You see the difficulty of the NFL disciplinary process, right? Because you have the prosecutor, you know, in the Kansas City area saying they believe a crime has been committed, but they can't move forward with charges because they didn't know which parent. But the difference is that, you know, the NFL is not looking to press, you know, criminal charges. They're just, you know, determining whether this player should be on the field or should be, you know, forced to miss a certain number of games. And that is always an inexact calculation, right? What offense equates to what? But I think, you know, in the case of Hill, whether or not they pressed criminal charges isn't the relevant factor here. We have a couple things. You know, the most recent report that said they determined there was a local radio or TV station in Kansas City recently, yesterday, had a report saying that they determined the broken arm very quickly was not a result of anything, you know, that happened in the house. They said it was a result of the child falling. However, later in that same report, they also mentioned that the child was found to have bruises and welts that had been through some kind of discipline by the parents. So you have that piece of evidence. And you also, you do have not a videotape, Albert, but you have an audio recording in which he threatens her. And yeah, this is a player that was off many teams' draft boards because he strangled his pregnant girlfriend, who is now, you know, the woman that he's co-parenting the child with, and they have twins on the way. So that is one of the most violent forms of domestic abuse, is strangulation, right? Like that results in an escalation in many places of charges. And then you have him on tape saying, "You need to be terrified of me too," and using an expletive. So in my mind, those things, all of those things together, are enough to warrant punishment, even potential banishment. I mean, I it's so hard for me to understand why we're parsing things out of the criminal charges when there is very clear evidence that other things have happened in addition to what happened before he entered the league, right? So when the Chiefs drafted him, they said they had a zero tolerance policy. Yep. And he is clearly beyond, you know, this is clearly an incident that violates a zero tolerance policy.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any question. You know, you can even go like, okay, so what does accidental mean? Is it accidental, like that he broke his arm after the parent, like after the parent shoved him to the ground? You know, like it's like there's so much.
It's so hard to tell that. Yeah, and then you have the right child saying, "Daddy did it." You know, per the audio recording, the mother is saying that the child said, "Daddy did it." You have a lot of evidence here.
Yeah, it's just, and if you say zero tolerance, then you can't just, I just feel like you can't give like if the team is giving the team's giving a player who doesn't deserve benefit of the doubt, right? And so now I think the team doesn't deserve benefit of the doubt, because the team has the team has operated and taken risks on players in the past, and we've seen this over the last, you know, really since Andy Reid and John Dorsey got there in 2013, the Chiefs have not been shy about taking risks on guys. And this is another one of those risks. And it's just, at some point, like, you'd like to see the team take responsibility for the risks that they took. And it sort of, to me, like, and I don't know how you look at this, Connor, but like, I think for me, it's like it paints the Kareem Hunt decision in a different light. You know, because you look at it back then and it's like, okay, like they're putting their foot down. Now that looks like, well, no, you just saw Kareem Hunt as expendable, and you saw the loss of him as a player as manageable, and you saw Tyreek Hill as indispensable, and maybe his loss on the field is unmanageable. And so now, instead of dealing with that situation, you're deciding to sort of play the delay game here, where you hope that if this thing goes on for long enough, that he can show up to training camp at the end of July and it'll just go away. And I just, I don't think it would fly in another market either. I think that's the other part of this.
I mean, they're just so far down this rabbit hole of slime at this point that, you know, I mean, there's really nowhere else for them to go. I mean, they didn't cut him immediately. They said they wanted to let the investigation play out, and now it seems like they're just trying to figure out a way to quietly usher him back on the field. And, you know, you guys have both mentioned some great points where, you know, if a player is still effective, he's going to get, swept back into the league, and if he's not, he's going to be kicked out, and then they're going to couch that in terms of, oh, justice, and we're following these rules. But nobody is. I mean, nobody is following these rules because there's no punishment for the teams or the coaches doing this. I mean, there's no disincentive for drafting a player like Tyreek Hill, because if it works out, you can claim that you're this rehabilitator and that, you know, that's the culture that's taking care of everything. And if it doesn't, then you just cut him and say that we're a team that follows the, you know, all these policies to the letter of the law. But, you know, then there's this gross middle ground, which, like, we seem to find ourselves in time and time again, where, I mean, Kareem Hunt got signed, you know, he's on another football team right now. I mean,
all right, so hang on a second, real quick, do you think that's the answer, punishment for the teams?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I think that, like, we've talked about before, I mean, there's always that problem, right? I mean, that goes back to the zero tolerance issue, right? Does it make people more afraid to come forward? Does it affect that process? Because that's the thing that you don't want. That's the thing that you want to cultivate the most. You want people to be comfortable and confident in coming forward and understanding that their problems are going to be heard. Does punishing the team affect that? I mean, there needs to be some sort of research done there or something so we have a better idea of that. But yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of these coaches that and a lot of these general managers that build rosters on these types of players should feel some of the backlash for this because they know what they're doing. And, you know, all these coaches are very smart to be able to get into the position that they're in. You're not an idiot to be able to rise to the rank of head coach. And there's an element of being that operator there. And that's what you're doing. You're ushering these guys onto your roster knowing how you're going to handle it.
Yeah, you know, Mike Rosenberg wrote a column about that on our site, and Mike Florio had, I think, perhaps the initial idea of should there be some kind of punishment for teams who take a risk on a guy like Hill, and then he reoffends. And I understand there's both sides of it. There is some criticism, like, why are you heaping on punitive measurements when we know women are scared to come forward? But the benefit of something else that I see would be the idea that teams would have a stake in providing resources and working with the guy not to reoffend. The way it is now, you can just draft a guy, fifth round pick, hope to get 3 years out of him, and then if some things go awry, oh well, because we still got our value on the fifth round pick, right? They don't really have... There is some level, okay, we want this guy on our team, but, like, there's not a, they don't have a huge stake in saying, let's just make sure we work with him and that we have specific resources in place to help him not reoffend.
It's so interesting, Jenny, too, because what you just said, I think, is the way that all these teams look at it. And I'll give you, like, I think the best example is Aaron Hernandez. And the Patriots took him in the fourth round thinking, all right, like, if this doesn't work out, like, and they had heard the gang rumors and everything else before the draft. If this doesn't work out, well, it's just a fourth round pick. We can get rid of him. Well, then what happened? Well, you know, then because he's talented and because that was the reason they took the risk in the first place, he all of a sudden became an important part of the team. And now they're starting to tell themselves, even though they're seeing things, they're starting to tell themselves, oh, well, we can manage it. It'll be okay. Because now all of a sudden he's building equity inside the building because he is making an impact on the field. They give him a new contract. And then that spring before everything happened, all of a sudden now, okay, well, he's going to work out in California. He's going to get this apartment. He's going to do all these different things. And look, I'm not pinning what happened with Aaron Hernandez on anybody, but there's like a natural progression there that happens, you know, where it's like you take a very talented guy late in the draft thinking, okay, like I can just get rid of this guy. Then that guy winds up, you know, building that equity inside the building. And now all of a sudden, like the team sits there and is like, well, I don't want to get rid of him. He's a great player. And I think that's exactly what happened with Tyreek Hill is the Chiefs took him initially in the fifth round thinking like, okay, like, well, if this doesn't work out, we're just going to get rid of him. Right.
Right.
Well, it didn't work out that way. Like he wound up being a very, very good player. And over 3 years, he built equity in that building as a player more so than as a person. And now all of a sudden, you know, the team is in this position where, you know, like they're, I mean, it's almost like it's like revealing who, you know, like it's revealing the way that this system really works. And I think that I don't know, there's a lot of this that's really, really ugly.
Yeah. I mean, you see teams taking advantage of an inefficiency of the market, right? To get a talented player below where his talent would have warranted him being drafted. In some respects, they're building a football team, right? I mean, so maybe this is the whole flaw of sports teams, you know, asking them to be the final answer on some of these issues. But at the same time, they're taking players, elevating them to very prominent places in communities and nationally. And they are saying, when we draft these players, I wouldn't bring someone into my community that I thought was a risk. That's what John Dorsey said when they drafted Hill. So basically, then you do have a responsibility, right, to sort of at least take a some minimum number of steps, provide some kind of support system beyond just hoping that the locker room takes care of it.
Yeah, there's no question. This is a, there's a ton of stuff that if this was a lesser player, there's no question the Chiefs would have been rid of him by now. All right, news topic number four. The Jets shelled out big money for Eagles personnel man Joe Douglas to be their next general manager. Once again, the team now has a coach and a general manager on different contracts, with Joe Douglas on a 6-year deal and Adam Gase on a 4-year deal. I think that this is a good example of a candidate for a job knowing that the team desperately needed him, and knowing that striking out on him would make a bad situation worse. I think the only thing that the Jets really would have been able to do to come out of this looking halfway decent was to go and get someone like Joe Douglas, based on his reputation, based on the way people around the league see him, based on the fact that his name was out there for over a month before this thing wrapped up. And so, I don't know, guys. Like, I sort of look at this as, like, you know, Joe Douglas and Jimmy Sexton and everybody involved on that side of it seeing, you know, the Jets badly needed some sort of PR bump here and badly needed something that would help them turn the page. And he was the key to doing it. And I think it's a really good hire. Like, I'm not saying there's nothing against the hire, but I think that the fact that he was able to get the money in the years that he was able to get out of the Jets was absolutely a function of the position the team put itself in by firing Mike McCagnan when it did.
Yeah, 6 years is quite a long contract for a general manager. and, you know, the Jets ended up, I think, in a good place. I mean, Douglas is someone that would have warranted interest, you know, next year, you know, in the cycle. But, you know, I still think the criticism along the way that the team took, there was definite value in the criticism, right? Saying that, you know, perhaps the reason that they were slow to make the move was, you know, perhaps Christopher, you mentioned, Albert, that Christopher Johnson hadn't been in the building a ton, and they let McCagnan play a hand in picking the head coach and then shipping him out a few months later. So that was the root of the criticism here, right? I mean, it's not necessarily that they decided to move on from McCagnan, because a lot of people thought that was a move they needed to make. It was just allowing McCagnan to have a hand in picking Gase and then moving on from him a few months later.
It was the handling of it, bottom line. It was, okay, like, we're going to go forward with Gase. And, you know, after the draft, it was, you know, we're still unified as one. Mike McCagnan, Adam Gase, like the groups together. And then just suddenly pulling the plug a few weeks later. I think it was, you know, an inexperienced owner showing that inexperience. The whole thing was a mess. There's no question about it. And if I was Joe Douglas, I would have concerns too. And Connor, it sort of reminds me of what happened with the Niners. If you remember, a few years ago, they went from Jim Harbaugh in 14 to Jim Tom Sewell in 15 to Chip Kelly in 16. Trent Baalke, the GM at the time, had trouble getting along with all of them. And it was firing after firing after firing, change after change after change. And if you remember, they had to give John Lynch a 6-year deal. They had to give Kyle Shanahan a 6-year deal. And I guess that's just sort of the price of doing business if you're one of these teams that's made a mess of itself and has to convince some guy that you're not going to be totally unstable with them too.
It's funny because, you know, owners always try to optimize costs, but that is literally the cost of the, you know, them being an absentee owner, right? You literally have to pay, what is it? If Joe Douglas is making $3.5 million a year, $7 million is the price of your incompetence. It's two extra years, right, that you had to put on to that contract because he wouldn't go anywhere else. And so as an owner, I think that while I don't think it will really change anybody's operating procedure, that's really should come back to you. That is an indication of how you're doing your job. Is I messed it up enough that I literally had to pay this guy more than anybody else would in the league for an extra 2 years just because I created this mess. And so, you know, maybe it's an eye-opening experience, but I doubt it. You know,
well said, Connor.
I mean,
I think it like I think the plus here for Christopher Johnson, and we've killed him, like we've killed him in the last couple of weeks, and I think a lot of it's deserved. The one thing, the one upshot of all of this, because I think we saw this with Jed York in San Francisco a couple of years ago, like the 6-year deals to me, to Lynch and to Shanahan. Now we'll see whether or not that works out or not. I don't know. But I think that those 6-year deals were at least like an acknowledgement from ownership. I messed this up. And I sort of think the same thing exists here, that Christopher Johnson is acknowledging, like, I did not handle this well. And I'm willing to go the extra mile to get a good candidate. And I understand I messed it up. And that's why I'm not paying the market rate. That's why I'm paying above market. So I don't know. Jenny, to me, it feels like at least like he's acknowledging that he didn't handle the last couple of months very well.
No, that's fair. And again, like I think the Jets are in a decent spot moving forward, right? I mean, I think, you know, there are reasons to think that this, you know, maybe these could be the right people to head the team into the next chapter. But like you said, Albert, it was all about the handling of it and just the fact that the last few months sort of seemed rudderless. The fact that they got into a good place out of all of it, it doesn't really speak to sort of the messiness of the process, I think.
Interesting, right, note on Joe Douglas's contract is that when he's finished with a 6-year deal, John Gruden will still have 9 years left on his Raiders contract.
That was also some good on the spot math.
I'm high on jet fuel too, though. Let's do it. Team of 2019.
There it
Jets.
Is. There it is. It all, like, I think so much of it's going to ride on how the quarterback plays anyway.
You said it was a coach's league, Albert.
I know. But like so much of it's going to ride on how Sam Darnold plays. Well, but the coach has an impact on that, right?
Right.
Like, and I can't believe, by the way, I do want to go back to the Patriots thing, because the one thing we've been talking about, like, why it's so hard to replicate New England, right? Like, what's the hardest thing to replicate? The hardest thing to replicate is getting the greatest quarterback of all time with the 199th pick in the draft. That is the thing that's impossible to replicate.
And a below-market contract.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, news item number 5. Jenny, Connor, who wants to take it?
Go for it, Orr.
Let's see here. A less than sexy gaggle of holdouts are populating this summer's all-pay-me team. Yannick Ngakoue and Chris Jones won't be seen anytime soon. While Julio Jones and Malcolm Jenkins are present and accounted for, will either of them get a payday before legit football is happening?
Okay, no, it's not the sexiest group of names. These are good players, though, right? Like, I think all of these guys, Julio Jones is a sexy name. The other three, they're all good players. I think the difference between the first two Connor mentioned and the other two Connor mentioned are, I think Julio Jones and Malcolm Jenkins, because they've already gotten paid, because they're a little bit older, Jenkins will be going on to his fourth contract if he gets one. Julio will be going on to his third contract. I think those guys are probably a little more comfortable that the team is eventually going to take care of them. Whereas Ngakoue and Chris Jones maybe have some doubts about it. They haven't made all that much money yet. And the price tag at their positions, like Chris Jones is an interior defensive lineman, what Aaron Donald got. Yannick Ngakoue as an edge rusher, what Khalil Mack and Frank Clark and DeMarcus Lawrence got. Like, the market's exploded at those positions. So if those guys think that, like, if I sit out, if I push the envelope here, I'll be able to secure my future financially, then I absolutely think it's worth doing this. And if you don't trust that the team's not going to do it without a push, then go nuts. Go do it, because there's every chance in the 16 games in the fall that something happens to either of these guys where they won't be able to make nearly as much as they can right now. And both those guys are coming off of really good years. And so I understand why Julio and Malcolm are decided to show up, because I think they're comfortable with where they are, their spot in the teams, their financial security, all of that. At the same time, I think you look at Yannick Ngakoue and Chris Jones, and it's like, strike while the iron's hot. Like, I don't blame them for that at all.
I'm a big fan of the holdout process in general. I think that not only does it get you extra time off when you don't have to do work if you don't feel like it, but it adds an organic fuel to your fire, because you hear a lot of negative things then being said about you. And so when you are ready to come back, you arrive with a full tank, both emotionally and physically. And so, and worst case scenario, you're still making the exact same amount of money that you were before you decided to start the holdout.
Interesting.
Best part is when you report to camp and the first question comes and it's, people are saying that you've acted selfishly the last couple of weeks. What do you have to say to that?
I know what I would say.
I love the people are saying question.
People are saying is really a rough route to take.
Like, I don't want to ask you this, but yeah. So let me couch
I'm
it
not
as
saying
yeah.
it, but yeah. people are saying.
You know, as a random aside here, the Malcolm Jenkins numbers really reinforce that the safety has become like, I don't want to use the word. I passed on this topic because I didn't like the a less than sexy gaggle. Like, I just felt like me commenting using that word. But I will say that the sexiness of the safety position has really skyrocketed. And I think that the disparity in Jenkins' pay kind of reflects that. There's a lot of safeties in the league that are really good. Like, I've been like, ever since doing the All-Pro team last year, when I felt like there were way more options at safety than corner, I've been really pounding the drum for the safety position having this renaissance.
Yeah, Tyrann Mathieu got $14 million per. Landon Collins got $14 million per.
Yeah.
Earl Thomas got $14 million per.
A lot of.
I don't blame Malcolm Jenkins for wanting a little more.
Right, right.
I think you should always hold out. Hold out. Just hold out.
Sir, what's your plan?
Because what's the team going to do if you're not useful to them anymore?
Right.
So once Orr completes his pass under Sean McVay, when you successfully reach that benchmark, then you're just going to hold out.
You know what you should do? You should complete that first pass and then stage a hold out.
Like in the middle of the game.
Walk off the field. Yeah. Walk off the field.
My completion percentage will never be higher than that.
That's right.
You'll have the NFL record for completion percentage.
Wow.
So
I do think there's that pesky minimum number of attempts, but we can just forget about that.
Yeah, I would hole up in deep in Key Biscayne somewhere and just jet ski.
Favorite bartender.
Yeah, and then let them come to me, you know? Let everybody come to me.
Okay, cool. All right, guys. Well, next week we'll be deep in the abyss of the NFL summer. We'll see you guys then. All right, now I'll jump right into the six-pack. You guys know how this works. Every week I put the call for questions out on Twitter. I ask, you answer. If I pick your question, you get a like on Twitter. That means I hit that little heart there, and you're going to get your answer right here. And my first question for the week coming from Steve, that's at Steven Dudenath. Wentz getting extended before Dak says everything about how the Eagles feel about their guy and the boys feel about theirs. Dak hits the open market in 2020. Agree or disagree? I vehemently disagree with that. I think chances are they're going to be able to find a middle ground at about $30 million per year. The structure is going to be the important part, how the guarantees work, how the cash flow works, all of that. But even if they can't get a deal done, Dak Prescott's getting franchised. There's no other answer on that roster. If you look forward at, you know, what free agents are going to be available at the position next year, just there's no way Dak Prescott is making it to the open market in 2020. So absolutely not. You can remark that down. Dak Prescott will not be an unrestricted free agent in 2020. Question number two from Ethan Wegeler. That's at Doc Wiggs. Give me top five, quote, not bad football movies. And this is a nod to our podcast series, the MMQB Bad Football Movies podcast. And that's hosted by Connor Orr. He's done a great job with it the last few weeks. You guys can check it out on the podcast feed. I would tell you guys the number one football movie of all time, and I'm Googling right now, but the number one football movie of all time, without question, is The Program. I'm hoping to be part of the Bad Football Movies podcast so we can review that with a couple people who haven't watched The Program, but The Program would be number one for me. Number two, I'm going to go a little off the board here, and I'm just doing this, like, honestly, right off the top of my head. Number two, I'll say Remember the Titans, a classic from the year 2000. Number three, let's go with Let's go with Friday Night Lights. And I'm not talking about the TV show. I'm not talking about Varsity Blues. Friday Night Lights, the actual movie that was based on the book, thought that was really, really well done. Number four, Varsity Blues. Number five, Rudy. So there you go. There's your top five. That's subject to change because I did it right off the top of my head. Question number three. This is from Knowingly at Knowingly Fair. Will OBJ be an asset or a liability for the Browns? I think he's going to be an asset. I think despite all the drama, despite everything that's gone on here, I do think it'll work out for a couple reasons. Number one, Freddie Kitchens' ability to handle personalities. He handled big egos, big personalities in the past. I think he's going to help make this work. I think number two, it's going to be the presence of Jarvis Landry. When those two were together at LSU, those guys were not a problem. And the reason why, they kept each other locked in. Every day, those guys walked into a receiver room not knowing if they were the best player on that day in that room. They were competitive with each other. It helped fuel both of them, put both of them in position to be drafted fairly high. And I think the Browns, I know the Browns' bet is on that happening again. I think there's a good chance it does. Question number four is from Pardon My Bullsh podcast. That's at the PMB pod. Wonder where you got that name from. Who's your MVP front runner? Hashtag PMB podcast. My MVP front runner for the 2019 season, and this may surprise some people, I'm going to go with Andrew Luck. I think Luck came on at the end of last year. He didn't look great in the divisional playoffs at Kansas City. There's no question about that. But I think based on what they've put around him, I think based on the fact that he's another year off the shoulder, I think based on the fact that some of the mechanical things that he's worked on have started to take, you know, the work he's done with Tom House and Adam Dato, all that stuff started to take. I think Andrew Luck's got a real chance to have a huge, huge year, and he's got a much better team around him. One name I would watch in Indianapolis, who I don't think is going to be great at the beginning of the year, but may come on later in the year, who they loved in training camp last year, Deion Kane, the sixth-round pick out of Clemson. He tore his ACL in the summer last year. He was having a huge training camp. I think he's a player who could be an impact player for them. Question number five. This is from John Benger. Which is more important to the development of the game outside the U.S.? International player pathway, increase in London, Mexico games, UK franchise, or potential for draft in London, etc. For me, NFL UK is ready for it all, but will the new CBA allow it in 2022? I actually am going to give you an answer you might not expect here. I'd say the international player pathway. I think the key to making football work overseas and to the popularity of it really growing is getting kids playing the game and having it embedded in the schools and having it so kids it's actually a part of your childhood. I think that's such a big piece of all of this. I think the reason why people pay attention to international soccer in the U.S. more now than ever before, largely because of that, largely because kids have been playing the game for 20, 30 years now. And I think that's the advantage, quite honestly, that basketball's had over the other sports here. It's so easy to export. All you need is some blacktop and a couple of hoops, and kids can play. And so and it's a star-driven sport, so you know, you've got identifiable celebrities that are part of the game, all that different stuff is part of it. And so I think getting kids playing is very, very important. Finally, question number six. This is from Chris. That's at Chris Lynham. Is the AFC South the Colts to lose? I'm going to say yes. I think the AFC South might be the best division in football in 2019, which is crazy based on where it was a couple of years ago. I think the Indianapolis Colts have another very, very good rookie class added to last year's rookies and the growth that I think they expect to see from guys like Quentin Nelson and Darius Leonard and Braden Smith. And I just think that you're going to see a second year group that's even better than it was as rookies. And then I think you're going to see another good rookie class from Chris Ballard and that scouting crew. Frank Reich has done a really nice job there. The AFC South favorite indeed should be the Indianapolis Colts. Be hard for me not to say that after I just said Andrew Luck's going to be the league MVP. Appreciate you guys coming out. As always, we love your feedback. You can get to me on my social media channels, on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. We want to make this your podcast as we get closer to the season. We could make some changes. Your input would help us do that. And as always, remember to listen to all the MMQB podcasts, the Monday Morning Podcast with Gary Grambling and Andy Benoit, the Bad Football Movies podcast, which has been great of late, hosted by Connor Orr, and of course this podcast that we do every week with Connor and Jenny. You can get us on Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. We'll see you guys then.